even where there is wide scholarly, and this is 752, even there, excuse me, even where there is a wide scholarly consensus concerning a particular matter, the truth is served by allowing that consensus to be challenged without fear of reprisal. Today's accepted wisdom sometimes turns out to be mistaken. And in these contexts, even a false statement may be deemed to make a valuable contribution to public debate, since it brings about the clearer perception and livelier impression of truth produced by its collision with error, citing U.S. Supreme Court. That's the essence of what we have right here. That's the facts that have been alleged. Essentially, the state's position is, because, as alleged, what President Trump said speech-wise or expressed either through his speech or conduct, which is still freedom of expression, because that's false in the eyes of the state, it's lost all protections of the First Amendment. And the concurring opinion, the dissenting opinion in Alvarez suggests just the opposite. If anything, under the circumstances, it needs more protection, not less protection. So, keeping that in mind, let's move to not RICO. Put RICO aside for a minute. Let's move instead to the conspiracy counts, which are counts 9, 11, 13, 15, 17, 19. Basically, what the state's position is on that, because it took this position previously in its filing on September 27, 2023, in response to that which was filed by Chesbro. And I'm aware, of course, of the court's order that dealt with Chesbro, and it didn't deal with the as-applied. So I'm dealing...
And more so in that one, as I go back and look at it, there was a much more kind of concerted effort to bring in facts outside of the indictment, right? And they started talking about, well, there was a transcript at the meeting, there was this, you know, so it didn't really seem to be a true as-applied challenge, right?
But as the court noted in its order, at that point it didn't determine that it was ripe for a pretrial challenge. So I'm taking what Chesbro, what the state said, as it applies now, because it says in that brief that it was both as to facial and as applied challenges. Essentially what it says is, as to those counts, 9, 11, 13, 15, 17, 19, as to 9, 11, and 17, the mere fact that it alleges a fraud is enough. That is, that's what's on page 5 and page 6. Since each of those statutes prohibit conduct involving fraud, we don't go any further. And I'm suggesting that's wrong, that you must go further. You must look at the speech itself, the expressive conduct itself, in connection with those specific statutes. That's what the as applied is. The fact that it's a fraudulent statute, now you want to look and see why, under the circumstances here, the language speech of the president falls within that. And if you look at it in that sense, the mere fact that it's false is all that they have. There's not a finding that the speech itself, beyond the speech itself, is fraudulent. What the state wants to do is say, we have a goal. We have an objective here that we have put forward. Steal the election in an unlawful fashion. I say, change that for a second to legitimate concern about the validity of the election. If that was the way you've focused on it, which is a way to do it as applied, even with the facts, would what President Trump said on those counts be a protected speech? And the answer is it has to be, because the only thing that makes it fraudulent is the state saying it's false. Take every one of those and say, okay, it's not false. It's protected. The only reason it becomes unprotected, in the state's opinion, is because they call it false. And that's what Alvarez doesn't allow. In and of itself, it cannot be simply the content-based. It has to be contextual. And the contextual here is a political core value being addressed, elections and campaigning. And that holds true for the all of those that deal with the conspiracy. And then you deal with counts 29 and 39, which is the false statements charges. Now, it is clear that the Supreme Court would find that a statement made under 1001, 18 U.S.C. 1001, would constitute the appropriate, let's say, abridgment or non-protected conduct or speech. But Georgia's statute's a little different here, because we don't have a materiality element. It's the mere fact of falsity which violates, according to Georgia law, counts 29 and 39. You don't have to do anything else but make a false statement, even if it is political discourse, even if it is in the heightened context that I've suggested. If it's false, it's a violation of the law. And I'm saying, as applied to political speech, that can't be constitutional as applied. Remember, no materiality, simply the fact that he said it. So essentially, what the state's position on that would be, it didn't have to be sent to anyone of consequence in the state agency. It just had to be said. Indeed, if you look at, and the most probably best example is count 39, that's a letter written after the election in September of 2021 from President Trump to Secretary of State, in which it has, according to that, one statement. And that constitutes, according to the state, falsity, but it's clearly political speech. And it's clearly being related to the activities and the matters that of election and campaign, even after the fact. It's still related just to that. So looking at 29 and 39, I think you have a situation in which the falsity alone is all they have as applied here to political speech. It is unconstitutional as applied under the First Amendment. And then finally, you have count 27.
Quick question on that. Had you, I hadn't located one. Had you found anyone ever attempted a facial challenge on 16-10-20?
Yeah, in fact, I don't remember the name of the case, but it has been upheld, even though there was references to the fact that maybe materiality should be part of it.
That's got
to
be the Haley case. That's right. That's right. Okay.
So, yes, facially, yes. But Haley, of course, didn't go to the extent of trying to determine as applied in a particular context. And it's, again, I don't wish to repeat what I just said, but here we're talking about the heightened value of core political speech. And then with 27, we're talking about the filing of a false document. Again, the only thing there that involves President Trump is an attestation on the complaint. Now, all it refers to in the indictment is complaint. But again, we're talking about the act, the falsity, or the filing of false document is the falsity in the document itself. And I'm suggesting under the circumstances that and that alone wouldn't violate that statute as applied. So regardless of the facial challenges, the question becomes here, is the mere fact that the state says fraud or false statement enough to get by an as-applied challenge? And our suggestion is it is not. Now let's go to RICO. And I think RICO is more difficult, to be honest with you, because we're talking about a much broader statute. At the same time, when you look at the allegations against President Trump, all of the allegations involved expressive conduct or speech. We have false statements alleged in overt acts, and again, all of which are political core value, political discourse. You have false statements in overt acts 1, 5, 7, 8, 17, 93, 97, 108, 113, 133, 135, and 157. Purely, the only allegations there are falsity. There's no allegation beyond the fact that those statements are made. And I'm suggesting that, again, heightened political speech has to be looked at differently. When it comes to tweets, which is least the way the state sets it forth, is also political speech. And here, certainly by the then president of the United States, you have tweets in 22, 26, 27, 32, 75, 100, 101, 106, 114, 128, 138, and 139. So the majority of the overt acts involve false statements or tweets, which are clearly political speech. How best to deal with that under the circumstances? To prosecute those under a broad RICO charge, supposedly with contesting an election by, I guess, illegitimate speech or expressive conduct? Or is the way that we are set up as a country is that the First Amendment plays through this by others, by those that are complaining that it's false, proving it's false, bringing forth the truth? That's the essence of what Alvarez has said. That's the essence of what a case called Brown versus Hartledge, which is cited in Alvarez. It's 456 U.S. 45 at 61, a 1982 decision. All of those speak in terms of when you're dealing with that speech, that political speech, you're best to deal with it through the pushing forth a counter view of truth, not prosecuting the speech maker or the person that is articulating his political views. Here we've done just the opposite. We have decided that because those views were unpopular and in state's opinion false, we must prosecute them to stop them from happening again, which is, again, the essence of why it's unconstitutional as applied, because that's not what the law says. Finally, the rest of the overt acts, either the telephone calls or meetings or requests, no false statements. They're just acts, expressive acts. And they're in there as well. Those are political acts. And for the court's benefit, because I know there's a lot of overt acts, those are 9, 14, 19, 28, 30, 31, 40, 42, 43, 44, 90, 95, 112, what was in the old indictment is 123, paragraph number 2 is now, I think, is 125, 130, 131, 140, and 156. There is nothing alleged factually against President Trump that is not political speech. So what this court has to decide is the state's position that fraud or false statements under these circumstances, which I suggest really is alone, is that enough to get it by an as-applied challenge? Our position is it's not. Is there another way to look at this? They're going to argue at the same time that it's integral to criminal conduct. But it's the speech that's being punished. That is the criminal conduct. If it's not the criminal conduct, there would never be an indictment for the RICO against President Trump or any of these other counts. Take out the political speech, no criminal charges. Political speech disagreed with, basis for all charges. I think that is the best way for me to sum up where our position is.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sadow. All right, Mr. Wakeford or Mr. Floyd, if there are any points that you wanted to address or respond to. I'll start you off with this. It certainly seems that the primary case driving Mr. Sadow's argument would be Alvarez. And, you know, because that's a fractured kind of plurality opinion, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on just how much that can drive this. And I know the state back in December was also citing Alvarez as the primary case. I wonder if that's even the best one.
Well,
for your arguments,
I think to address the first, I think, elephant in this courtroom is that a Judge Chotkin in D.C. has evaluated all of these arguments under Supreme Court precedent already. So I would refer Your Honor to that court's analysis because I'm hardly going to improve upon the findings of a federal judge. However, speaking specifically to Alvarez, it is a plurality opinion with several different opinions written by other justices. What they all agree on, though, is that Alvarez doesn't change the law that speech integral to criminal conduct is not protected under the First Amendment, and that that's not what Alvarez was about. It was about punishing falsity for its own sake. So the question is that what the state is doing here? And by fundamentally rewriting the indictment, the defendant is suggesting today that that is somehow what the state is doing, when actually what the state is saying is that these statements made by the defendant were all employed as part of criminal activity, various conspiracies, frauds, intentions with deceit, and violations of the law. It's not just that they were false. It's not that the defendant has been hauled into a courtroom because the prosecution doesn't like what he said. He is free to make statements and to file lawsuits and to make other legitimate protests. What he is not allowed to do is employ his speech and his expression and his statements as part of a criminal conspiracy to violate Georgia's RICO statute, to impersonate public officers, to file false documents, and to make false statements to the government. That's what he's alleged to do. He's not charged under 16-1020 because he told some lies. Although it is very interesting to hear counsel for Mr. Trump tell us about the usefulness of lies. He's not being prosecuted for lying. He's being prosecuted for lying to the government, an act which is illegal because it does harm to the government. That's the reason that it's illegal. That's why it's different from the statute evaluated in Alvarez. Same thing with filing a false document. It's not just that you made a false statement. It's that you swore to it in a court document and submitted it to the court. That does harm to the judicial system. That's obviously different from just falsity being punished for its own sake. And that is what each and every charge in the indictment demonstrates, is that these statements are part of criminal conduct that is larger than just the false statement on its own, especially with the RICO charge, where what we see is that this is a criminal organization whose members and associates engaged in various criminal activities, including but not limited to false statements and writings, impersonating a public officer, forgery, filing false documents, influencing witnesses, computer theft, computer trespass, and on and on and on. What the defendant is suggesting to Your Honor is trying to get around to the fact that because it's almost saying that because these statements are false, that these charges should be dismissed. It's like, well, you can't punish falsity on its own, and yet each time you look at the charge, the government's saying, the state is saying that he lied. So that must be the end of the inquiry. But that's not the end of the inquiry at all. That's not what the indictment says. It's not just that he lied over and over and over again, as counsel for the defendant points out by listing all of the instances in the indictment. It's that each of those was employed as part of criminal activity with criminal intentions. And we finally get to a place where where I knew we would end up, which is saying, I believe Your Honor was requested to think about it as not as lies, but as legitimate concern about election issues. Well, that sounds like a trial argument to me. But this is why I began by talking about intent with Your Honor, because I knew we were going to end up in this exact place where he said, sure, you can look at them as lies because they weren't true, or you could think this is just well-intentioned concerns from an American citizen speaking his mind. And that, of course, would probably be a pretty good argument to put before a jury, and I expect we will see it, but it's not a basis for dismissing the indictment. The whole question of intent is no doubt going to be brought up. It can only be determined by a jury. But what we have heard here today is an attempt to rewrite the indictment, to take out the parts that are inconvenient and only say, well, it's all speech, it's all talking, and he was just a guy asking questions and not someone who was part of an overarching criminal conspiracy trying to overturn election results for an election he did not win, by violating the RICO statute, by making false statements to the government, by filing false documents, by impersonating officers, and doing a whole host of other activity which is harmful in addition to the falsity of the statements employed to make them happen. So I think there's been a suggestion that Your Honor can sort of reframe what you're looking at, but Alvarez does nothing to shift the basis that the court should stand upon when evaluating the indictment. And that is to say, is this speech being punished solely because it's false, solely because of its viewpoint? Or is it speech that's being demonstrated as integral to a pattern of criminal activity? And finally, the fact that it speaks to political concerns or core political speech, and this is something that the court in D.C. Thoroughly addressed, does not change the fact that it can be employed as part of criminal conduct. It, the mere fact that you're talking about issues of public concern or core political speech, which may be completely fine and protected in certain, in most contexts, does not mean that you cannot be indicted if you use that kind of speech to pursue illegal activities. That's the whole nature of the question. So it's very circular, and I would direct Your Honor to page 6 to 7 of the post-hearing brief filed by Defendant Trump, which says, the speech integral to criminal conduct exception of the First Amendment does not apply here because all the charged conduct constitutes First Amendment protected speech. That is a very neat circle. The First Amendment protects us because all the speech is protected by the First Amendment. And in the end, no matter how much we hear about the obviously the noble protections afforded by the First Amendment, all of this is an effort to get Your Honor not to look at the basic fact that this speech, this expression, all this activity is employed as part of a pattern of criminal conduct in a host of ways. And because Your Honor is bound by the indictment and has to look at the indictment and can't look beyond it, if we're going to get into this at this stage, then there's nowhere to go, as I said at the beginning, because this is all alleged as part of a pattern of criminal conduct and not protected by the First Amendment. Any argument to the otherwise is just to try to pretend like that's not true.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wakeman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, may I add one point briefly?
Sure.
Thank you.
Wait a second. We're being doubled up on here?
This is not a trial. I think you can handle it, Mr. Sadow.
I'm just going to be on one specific point, not duplicate the argument made before. I believe Defendant Trump fundamentally misunderstands the role of an overt act in a conspiracy case. As we've discussed many times previously, this is a RICO conspiracy case. And so we heard Mr. Sadow discuss various overt acts and say, well, but this is just a tweet, this is just a phone call, this is just X. The unspoken, underlying, and incorrect premise then is that every overt act must be a crime. As we've discussed a number of times, and as the state has set forth extensively in multiple briefs, that's not true. The purpose of an overt act is to show that the conspiracy is in operation. It is not a separate crime. It doesn't have to satisfy the elements. It doesn't have to be pled with that level of detail, as Your Honor acknowledged in an order, I think, that's all of 2 weeks old. And so to say we can't mention this particular act or this particular conduct because it's not a crime or it's protected by the First Amendment, the answer to that is actually, so what? Because it could be first, it could be legal conduct, it could be First Amendment protected conduct. That also shows there's a conspiracy in operation. And that's, as long as it serves that purpose, it's fine. And so overt acts should not be examined by a standard that has no application to them. They are not separate freestanding offenses. And there is federal case law that, and if need be, we can cite it to you, that has said an overt act can involve First Amendment activity. Its purpose is not to be something that is separately charged here, separately subject to a separate sentence. Its purpose is to show that there is a conspiracy and it's in operation. Georgia Rico requires one overt act by any one defendant. So, of course, the RICO would stand if anything, any of the 161 overt acts alleged constituted an overt act. It would only take one. It doesn't take any by Mr. Trump. But the point is, we have an abundance of them by Mr. Trump, and for purposes of the RICO statute and the manner in which it functions, it doesn't matter whether that's First Amendment conduct or not. I mean, my colleague has fully explained why much of this conduct is not shielded under any circumstance by the First Amendment, and I don't mean to contradict that in any respect. But it's important not to lose sight of the function the overt act plays, the role it plays in a conspiracy case here, because it is not the role being suggested by Defendant Trump.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Floyd. All right, Mr. Sadow, I'll give you a couple minutes. Final word.
Thank you, sir. If I heard what Mr. Floyd just said, that if everything President Trump said was assumed true and included in the RICO indictment, and therefore now we're talking about true political speech, not alleged false, he could still be prosecuted for the violation of RICO.
But the overt acts as alleged, let's say even the overt acts ran afoul of the First Amendment. He's saying that wouldn't be fatal to count one.
Because at that point, if there could be
some other thing they prove that's not alleged as an overt act.
Okay. That may, as
I understand it.
As I understood it as well. But what I'm suggesting is, if all of the overt acts are nothing more than core political speech or expressive conduct, and nothing else is alleged which is not protected by the First Amendment, then you have an insufficient basis for which he has been indicted, because he's being indicted for First Amendment speech and not for unprotected speech. And therefore, the statement that was made about if it were true, we could still use it as an overt act, suggests that they can prosecute true speech, which is what we're trying to get to here. It's the nature of the speech, the political speech, the heightened value of such, which gets this situation different than others, and the fact that it comes from then President of the United States. Going back to what was said in addition by the state, what the state claims is criminal here is lying to the government. That's what it said. That's the exact reason why in several of the Supreme Court cases, it's been found to be protected speech, because it deals with the government and falsity in sense of communication with or to the government is best dealt with through true speech, not through prosecutions, because prosecutions chill speech. And when it comes to political core speech, what you don't want is chilled. I use, fortunately, I have a co-counsel that is able to pull things up and help me inform the court until the computer shuts down. And looking at what Haley says, just to give you an idea of how the Georgia court, the Supreme Court, might look at this, there's a quote from Haley, and it says, "While there is no constitutional value in false statements of fact, such erroneous statements are nevertheless inevitable in free debate, and punishment of error runs the risk of inducing a cautious and restrictive exercise of the constitutionally guaranteed freedoms of speech and press. Accordingly, the First Amendment requires that we protect some falsehood in order to protect speech that matters." And I think that's what we're talking about here. To end this, and again, we're focusing on President Trump's conduct that at the time that he, in fact, is the head of the executive branch. There is references to this in Brown v. Hartledge, and I cited that earlier. "A well-publicized yet bogus complaint on election eve raises the concerns that you may have some impact that would affect an election. But the preferred First Amendment remedy of more speech, not enforced silence, has special force. Underlying our dependence upon more speech is the presupposition the right conclusions are more likely to be gathered out of a multitude of tongues than through any kind of authoritative selection. To many, this is and always will be folly, but we have staked upon it all. And for speech concerning public affairs is more than self-expression. It is the essence of self-government." And that comes from Garrison v. Louisiana, which is cited also in Alvarez. Bottom line here is this. But for protected First Amendment speech, President Trump would not be charged in RICO or the other counts. Take out the protected speech, and you don't have an underlying basis for which to charge him. And since that violates the Constitution as applied to the charges here, and his speech here, and his position here, this is ripe for a constitutional challenge. One step further. If it's not ripe now, and we get into intent, when does the court determine that? Do you determine that after we have a trial?
I think it would be the directed verdict stage.
Well,
right?
But would it? That's a sufficiency of evidence.
With all inferences, yeah, in favor
of the
state.
That's a whole question. I mean, do we go through the whole trial? God forbid there should be a conviction. And then we go back to trying to determine as applied? I'm suggesting the reason it's ripe now and the reason why we don't even get to a trial is because it's unconstitutional to force an accused, be it the president of the United States, former president, or anyone else, to stand trial on protected speech. And I think that's what Alvarez and the progeny previous to that and after say.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sadow. All right. Mr. Gillen, do you need a minute before we dive in, or can we get started?
No, we're ready to go.
Okay. So just teeing this one up. I know there's a good bit of your motion that goes back into a lot of ground I think we covered at the December hearing.
Let me start off with some good news for the court.
I'm happy to hear it.
See the smile already on the court's
right,
face.
Well, consciously
our gentle and specific demur, a great deal of that does go into the areas of RICO that the court has not only ruled on but heard other arguments.
Well, I haven't ruled on it yet, but it was just
in October the 17th ruling addresses some of the issues that were addressed. So I'm not going to replow that ground. That the court has heard, you know, aware of the government's position. I know that probably ruined Mr. Floyd's day by not allowing him to get up and go back over his RICO expertise. I'm not going to do that. What I'd like to do, though, today is to move forward to some areas that I do think needs to be. And the question really when the court said, do we want to have oral arguments today or not? And then the question was, well, you know, because on the RICO thing, I think I probably could have said, if it was just the RICO component, I would have said, fine, let's just do it on the papers.
But you've got a lot of other counts.
There's some other things that I wanted to talk about and have the court focus on as it relates to some of the other aspects of the demurs, special and general demurs, and to focus on that in this way. Number one, I want to talk a little bit about some of the counts impersonating public officers. I want to talk about the forgery, the false statements, briefly, and talk about that, but also to raise this issue with the court. Now, we argued that in our pleadings, but the defendant still filed additional motions on these very issues and did a very, very good job in a lot of his arguments. We know that the court granted the stay for defendant Steele because he's of the state legislature, and thus, you know, had that not happened, Mr. Beaver would be here with me talking about these issues. I think that the Steele pleading addressed a lot of the issues that were raised in the response by the state, and so with the forgiveness, hopefully, of my dear friend, Mr. Beaver, I'm going to mention some of the things that they mentioned, but I would hope on behalf of defendants still, the court may listen to what I say, but also prior to ruling on these particular issues might afford defendants still the opportunity to have his own oral argument day so that he could more fully address these issues. And that's and I would appreciate that on his behalf. When we talk, let's get on to it. We're talking about impersonating a public officer charge, and we talk about that. When we talked about that, we talked about whether or not, the charge.
Definition of public officer, right?
Impersonating a public officer charge, count 8. We say that's subject to dismissal. In that pertinent part, it says on October the 14th, on or about December 2022, unlawfully, falsely held themselves out as the duly elected and qualified presidential electors from the state of Georgia public officers with the intent to mislead. Now, what we did in our pleading is we said, well, that is defective because under the statute 21-5-1, as public officer, there is no reference there to presidential electors as not as being public officers, and therefore that should carry the day for us. The state's response says, well, Not so fast, Mr. Gillen. We've got cases here that talk about situations which, in which 21-5-1 doesn't carry the day and isn't...
Well, not even cases. I mean, the statute itself.
Right.
I mean, you're pulling that from the ethics statute.
Exactly.
So I'm not really sure why I'd even look at that. I mean, public officers all throughout the code, and it's just kind of one of those hanging kind of question marks, I suppose.
So what the state does, and, you know, and I can see the court's point, I'm not going to argue that. What I am going to say is that what they say, they cite cases where there are individuals that are impersonating agents, you know, police officers, peace officers, or agents for Metro Atlanta Human Trafficking Task Force. Okay, that falls into that category. Trafficking in the task force or a federal agent. Those are things that the state responds to. I think that in the Still motion, it covers some of the concerns the court may have regarding this issue of public officer and why we think that we should prevail on this as well. Again, hoping Mr. Beaver has his day.
Well, do me the favor, actually, I've kind of put the Still motions in a box and I haven't opened it yet, so make those arguments for me.
Well, I'm going to,
all right.
But not as articulately, I'm sure, as Tom could do it, but I'll give you the flavor. The flavor of it is that in the Still motion, which we adopted after it was filed, it talks about how other case law in Georgia, when it talks about, first of all, 16-10-23 doesn't define public officer. So we start from that. So we've got that out there. Doesn't not defining the public officer. Now, but the Still pleading does say that the issue of who is and is not a public officer is addressed in other contexts in Georgia law. Usually in the merito proceedings where somebody is trying to find out the legitimacy of somebody having or holding a particular office. And in that context, there are cases citing in the Still pleading that address this very matter. They cite Brown v. Scott as a case in which the Brown v. Scott case, you know, whether or not an individual has designation or title given to him by law or exercises functions concerning the public assigned to him by the law, they cite Brown. That doesn't, the inquiry doesn't really end there. The Georgia Supreme Court has noted the term public officer involves the idea of tenure, duration, fees, emoluments, and powers, as well as that of duty. And so that's McDuffie v. Perkerson, and that has to do really with grand jurors. So when someone says, well, is a grand juror a public officer? And the court, you know, breaks down an analysis talking about that, saying, not really, because grand jurors may only meet for a few days. You know, they're not there for some sort of duration or tenure. They don't take the same oath of office as prescribed for public officers, and they lack the element of tenure and duration which must exist to qualify as a public officer. Okay. Well,
so how would that apply again to like a purely fictional task force?
Well, I mean, let's forget the purely fictional task force. It would let's have it. That case law from our Supreme Court, how it applies to our case, and how it applies to our case is the presidential electors are not people who have lengthy tenure duration, which it must exist. Frankly, their job is to meet for one day.
No, I see your framework there, but if the framework is actually in this, whereas the Metro Atlanta Human Trafficking Force, it doesn't even exist.
Well, it doesn't. But someone is pretending to be an agent.
Maybe they're a part-time. I mean, it seems like
we might agree to disagree here, because I think that when someone says, "Well, here's my badge. I'm an agent of enforcement of the law for," and then names a particular entity that doesn't even exist. They're pretending to be a peace officer. They're pretending to be an agent for the government, which, by the very nature of that job, would have tenure, would have responsibilities, would fall into the definition that the Supreme Court has given in Brown v. Scott and McDuffie v. Pearson as to what a public officer should be. And so in that context, we have, you know, we have the same thing, actually. It popped up again on the issue of in Morris v. Peters, another case, Supreme Court case, dealing with whether or not someone is a public officer. That had to do with a quo warranto against the chairman of the Georgia Democratic Party and whether or not he would fall in as a public officer. Bottom lining it, like in that case, and which found that he was not, like grand jurors and public official party officials, presidential electors are not public officials under Georgia law, especially for purposes of 1610-23. Their jobs, services are temporary, like the grand juries. Their position really only arises once every 4 years. It's limited to a single meeting on a single day. So it lacks that element of tenure and duration which must exist. So, you know, it's kind of like back to the political case, Morris v. Peters case, which dealt with a state party political chairman nominated in accordance with the rules of their party. But just because the fact that they were nominated by the rules of their party doesn't make them a public official. So, like grand jurors, presidential electors don't receive, they're not receiving their salaries for their service. So all of that, Your Honor, tells us that this particular count is flawed for the very purpose of these electors cannot be, under Georgia law, public officers. And so, although we agree with the court's initial position regarding the limitation on the definition of public officer in our pleading, good old Tom Beaver and the Still pleading has come forward to rescue us on that point. And so if you look at what they did, and hopefully Tom will do a better job of articulating those points. In their pleading, they talk about specifically some other cases that get into either in Texas and I think Utah as well that deal more specifically with this. But for the purposes of argument today, I think that we've sort of got the drift on what I think is happening on the impersonation of public officers. They're not public officers, and clearly under the direction we believe of our Supreme Court, they could not be so judged. Now, again, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time up here with the court, but I do want to touch on a few of the other components of our pleading, the forgery counts. Now, we indicated in those counts 10 and 16 are sufficient to dismissal. Writing a check in a fictitious name or a manner that the writing is made or altered purports to have been made by another person, that's the definition of 1610. We have what we have here in this indictment is we have an assertion that a writing or other than a check in a manner that the writing is made purports to be made by authority of the duly elected and qualified presidential electors from the state of Georgia who did not give such authority. Now, that's what they allege. Let's break that down as to why, and the state's response to us saying they want to focus on the phrase under the authority. And what we have here is the concept of what is the authority? Who is this on October the 14th? Who was the duly the duly elected and qualified presidential elector from the state of Georgia who did not give such authority on December the 14th, 2020. Now, the answer to that is that as a matter of law, simply as a matter of law, and we're going back, Your Honor, to some of the arguments we've made with the court earlier on the issue of supremacy clause, were worthy of at least highlighting some of those points to the court for the purpose of making our point here. And that is this, that, under the federal law as it existed in 2020, when the state of Georgia failed to comply with federal law about having an adjudication of any pending controversy or litigation, and as we know in the public record in this courthouse, was the pending and unresolved Trump and Schaefer litigation on the election. Now, because that lawsuit was not adjudicated pursuant to federal law, then the state of Georgia lost its ability after Safe Harbor Day, lost its ability to then name who the electors should be. And as we discussed earlier, and I'll shorten the argument, but for the purpose of the record, I'll just make the following points. Once that happens, and it's very, very clear from federal law and from the language from Bush v. Gore, the state, any
dissenting opinion in Bush v. Gore.
Yeah, true. But as it points there, it's like it's not, they see it as not even a serious issue, because the clear reading of the statute would say if you don't get it done by Safe Harbor Day, then you have lost out. And once that happens, the power then shifts back to the Congress. So as of by law, we think not a factual issue. By law, on December the 14th, 2020, there were no duly elected and qualified presidential electors from the state of Georgia because of that failure. And
so I understand your point, and I don't want to get too deep into it, but since we're in demur world here, wouldn't your allegation of whether a lawsuit was filed, whether it was pending, none of that's in the indictment. Doesn't that transform this into a speaking demur?
Well, we don't think so, and the reason why we don't is the last time I think we quoted the court that the court could take a notice of the pleadings within the court system, and I believe that what we articulated there, and I don't think we had an objection from the state, could be wrong, but my recollection is we didn't. That we then worked from the framework of yes, in this courthouse. There was a pleading that we're not going, this isn't a speaking demur, it's a part of the court record. Part of the court record says there was a lawsuit that was not adjudicated by Safe Harbor Day. So we don't have to go outside the indictment. It's not a speaking demur. And because of that, by applying the law, these forgery counts, 10 and 16, in our view, must go. Now, the other counts that I would like to, or the other matter I'd like to discuss, is the false statement component. On the false statement counts,
is that 14?
Of 12, 18, and 40, dealing with false statement. Now, here, the issue here, dealing with a false statement, for example, is when they're asserting that there was a document within that was sent within the jurisdiction of the office of the Georgia Secretary of State and the office of the governor of Georgia departments and agencies of the government. Now, we've got two arguments to that. Number one, and again, back to Haley. Haley talks about this issue, and when Haley talks about it, the key thing is whether or not there was agency with the key phrase with authority to act on it. Now, there are two flaws the fatal flaws the state has as it relates to this issue concerning Haley v. State and on the issue concerning the safe harbor. One, as we mentioned, at that time, there was nothing for the state of Georgia to act upon. They merely received the information. It was merely a ministerial act, if you would. But even more fatal to their argument is the second argument that I made a moment ago, which I won't repeat other than referencing it, the failure to act by safe harbor date renders any activity on behalf of the state of Georgia, be it the governor or the secretary of state, renders that gone, because now it's all gone back up to Washington, to Congress, to deal with that. And the government in the state can't now say, or at any time say, well, we're saying that the Democratic nominees or the Democratic representatives for the electors, they ultimately became the duly elected. You don't do that. You don't parachute back into what happened on December the 14th. The world as we know it on December the 14th, there were neither Democrat or Republicans that were duly elected under federal law. And so given that, we believe that the false statement counts should go. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Okay, any thoughts from the state in reaction? Mr. Wooten, this one's yours.
Yes, Judge.
Why don't we pick it up on that last point, because I know we've dived into some of this, not so much the safe harbor aspect of it in that argument, but the idea that the governor's office and the secretary of state's office just didn't have jurisdiction. I know you've said that that's an issue of fact that needs to be proven, but isn't that also something that could be shown by as a matter of law, potentially? And I know you don't agree to it, and so you can cover all that.
Sure. I don't agree that it's a matter of law. It is an issue of fact. And we've briefed this extensively and argued this before. We believe that even if it's not an issue of fact, even if the court were to consider it as a matter of law, we've given ample reasons why under statute all of these entities have jurisdiction over many of the crimes that are alleged in the indictment, all of the topics where we've alleged that some of these defendants have made false statements regarding. So I do maintain that I believe that it's an issue of fact for the jury to decide, that we have to put up that evidence. We have to ask the GBI officers, you know, what is your duty? What is your authority? What can you investigate? We have to ask the Secretary of State individuals while they're on the stand, what are your duties? What is your job? What do you do? Why are these things relevant? Why are these material to areas where you have jurisdiction to do something? What is your ability to act on these things? I think all of that has to come out at trial. And so as it relates to that argument, I think it's way premature. And anything that again, I always go back to the standard for what is a demurrer, right?
Right. But what I'm saying, just if there was a statute that explicitly, you know, said that they didn't have jurisdiction. Remind me, what is it that you're saying, just as a matter of law as apparent, that provides the governor authority over this after the safe harbor date?
Judge, I don't have the indictment in front of me, so I'd need to know specifically what statement we're talking. I think this is in regard to the the certificates or the paperwork where, you know, if an elector doesn't show up on election day or on December 14th, that the governor has to ratify a replacement of that person. I think there were some documents that were delivered by Mr. Schaefer and his co-conspirators to the governor's office, trying to get the governor to do that. That's provided by statute, that the governor is the one that has to ratify a replacement. So statutorily, he absolutely has the authority to act on that matter.
Okay. All right. So, from the top, I think there was a lot of time spent on definition of public officer and some of the allegations raised in Mr. Still's briefing, which I think his motion deadline should be coming up soon, so if he's requesting argument, we'd have him in.
Sure.
But if you want to make any initial reactions, have at it.
A well-prepared judge. All right. First, I want to kind of, I've made this statement in the past as it relates to Mr. Schaefer, and I'll make it again, which is we have to address an elephant in the room. The elephant in the room is that Mr. Schaefer is in the 11th Circuit right now demanding to be recognized as a federal officer. So what are we? I mean, are we saying that this position of elector is an officer or isn't? I think they need to make up their mind there. But as it relates to, I've actually got quite a bit of ground to cover, and I'll kind of take it as it was raised by Mr. Gillen. I want to start with, and again, as we pointed out in our response, we don't believe that the definition section in 21.5.3 applies.
I think it is much conceded that, so.
But, Judge, if it did apply, I think it actually supports us. Because if you look at paragraph B, this is 21.5.3.22B, it says public officer means every other elected state official not listed in subparagraph A. So it's a comprehensive definition of any elected state official. So we believe that that would absolutely cover it to the extent that it's persuasive that it shows that presidential electors are public officers. That definition says any elected state official. So they are elected state officials. I want to hit briefly on the cases that were raised by Mr. Gillen as it relates to what Mr. Still put in his pleadings, prepared to address those. First, there was an intimation that 1610.23 only applies to police officers or peace officers. We know that that's not true because of a case called Kennedy versus Carlton. That's 294 Georgia 576. 2014 Georgia Supreme Court case where a conviction was upheld for someone impersonating a DFACS employee, clearly not a police officer, a peace officer of any kind. So we can dispense with that argument. As it relates to the cases that Mr. Gillen referenced, the definition of public officer in other contexts, all of those cases deal with the definition of public officer in the context of a petition for quo warranto. I believe there's three cases that are referenced in Mr. Still's pleading. We're filing our response to that tomorrow, but I can kind of take them in turn. Mr. Gillen referenced this list of qualifications in the McDuffie case, tenure, emoluments, duties, etc. That's not the holding of McDuffie. So the way that the McDuffie case is structured is the Georgia Supreme Court says no one's ever definitively said what a public officer is in the context of quo warranto.
Well, look, if you're about to file a response and Mr. Beaver may be requesting oral argument, why don't we just save it for when I've had
sure,
a chance to
sure.
read I, these cases and we can be more productive.
Sure, I can skip those cases, yeah. But I did want to hit a few points, Judge, as it relates to the statutes that establish that presidential electors are public officers. First of all, the actual office itself is created by law. So it's created by the United States Constitution, Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2, and it's also created by OCGA 21-2-10. That actually establishes that there is an office of presidential elector in this state. They have duties that are established by law. Those are established both in the U.S. Constitution and the 12th Amendment, as well as at OCGA 21-2-11. By law, they're elected by the public, 21-2-10. And also, there was a reference that they don't get a salary. That's actually not true. There's a compensation for presidential electors that is set forth by law at OCGA 21-2-13. Additionally, the election code itself refers to the office of presidential elector. It refers to it as an office. In two places in particular, 21-2-132A and 21-2-132E. And again, we'd again rely on those cases that Mr. Gillen discussed, Garrison versus the state, 276 Georgia App 243, 2005 case, where someone was convicted for impersonating a federal agent, an unspecified federal agent, and that conviction was upheld by the Georgia Court of Appeals. Cert was denied by the Georgia Supreme Court. And then the Libri case where they, of course, impersonate the Metro Atlanta Human Trafficking Task Force that doesn't exist. So we would argue to the court that the definition for 1610.23's purposes that our appellate courts have applied a very liberal definition as a public officer. It doesn't even have to be a real public officer, doesn't have to be a state officer. Anything that purports to be, you know, someone acting by authority of the government is a public officer. And that's certainly what presidential electors do. Their positions created by law, their duties are established by law. All right, so jumping down to the forgery counts. Again, elephant in the room. 1691, there's at least five ways that you can violate the forgery statute. The cases that Mr. Schaefer relies on, Jackson versus the state, that's someone who was charged with forgery based on purporting a document purporting to have been made by another person. We did not charge under that provision of 1691. We charged under the final provision, which is by authority of one who did not give such authority. Mr. Gillen says that we didn't object to looking at these, you know, things and in the record in other cases. Let me be clear for the record, we do object. That's the definition of going outside of the indictment. So we agree with the court that considering those things outside of the indictment absolutely transforms that into a speaking demur. It's void. It can't be granted. If you look at the counts, the forgery counts, they track exactly the forgery statute. Case law tells us that that's what's sufficient for a general demur. I don't know that there's anything else to say about those counts. As it relates to the false statements, again, address that at the very beginning, but I would point out that in Haley, where both the conviction was upheld and the indictment itself was approved of, the indictment said this on the false statements counts. It said that the defendant did knowingly and willfully make a false and fictitious statement and representation in a matter within the jurisdiction of the GBI, a governmental agency, by calling himself the Catch Me Killer and stating that he killed 16 people. It doesn't allege any of the things that Mr. Schaefer says in his pleadings that have to be alleged. They don't have to be alleged. Like they've done in other motions, defendant here is trying to add elements to this offense that just don't exist, trying to add pleading requirements that don't exist. And Haley tells us the case itself directly quotes the indictment. That indictment alleges far less than what we allege in our indictment. And they said that the Georgia Supreme Court said that that case is just fine. I don't think that Mr. Gillen addressed the filing false documents motion. I believe in the pleadings they state that those counts are flawed because they fail to allege that the filing of the false documents didn't succeed. Again, that's not a requirement in an attempt charge. And they also say that the counts don't say who actually attempted to place documents in a mailbox. The way that we've charged the count, we've charged all of those defendants individually and as persons concerned in the commission of a crime. And so it'll be for the jury to determine if they have, if all the defendants are liable for what one of their co-conspirators did. With that, I'll take any questions the court might have.
Thank you, Mr. Worthen.
Thank you.
Okay, so Mr. Gillen, your last motion we had for today.
I have
Oh, sure.
60 seconds.
For sure, have at it.
The state did not and cannot answer the direct question about a violation of the safe harbor rule, why that would allow that situation to give the governor or the secretary of state any authority to do anything. That comes in under several of the arguments that we've made. I won't repeat it, but they simply, their argument is, let's put an agent up and ask the agent whether or not he had authority. No. By law, by federal law, they did not have the authority. It's not whether some GBI agent thinks that he can come in here and tell the jury, pay no attention to federal law, pay no attention to the dissenting opinion in Bush v. Gore, pay no attention to that. I'm a GBI agent. I say we can do it. That's wrong. They lose there because the law is very, very, very clear. And we can go back and we'll both the state and I know the Schaefer team will go back to look at our argument that we made to the court when my recollection could be wrong. I don't think so. We'll see. But my recollection was because the pleading was a part of the court system that we had a citation which permitted the court to take that into consideration as part of the record and thus not going outside of the record for speaking to Murr. I could be wrong, but we'll get that to you quickly because that, they latch onto that to say, pay no attention to the reality of what happened in this courthouse, in the court filings, which destroys their argument. And so with that, Your Honor, I'll sit down and then I'll go back and get my other folder.
So on your last motion here, kind of as we were with the First Amendment issue, I think we need to figure out where we are procedurally. You know, federally, it sounds like, you know, this would be a pretty common motion. It'd be a surplusage motion. Georgia, it's not quite as clear for us. So, excuse me. Let's start with just the authority to kind of take a scalpel to an indictment and cut out things we don't like.
Well, I mean, Your Honor, we talk about there are two components to this motion. One, there's the strike surplusage, and then there's a dismissal that we asked for, which is kind of also a component of the other. Now, we cite the State v. Corrin on the issue of being able to, the allegation, the indictment is not wholly unnecessary to constitute an offense as mere surplusage. We think.
Right. But when we read the surplusage opinions, we're talking about, you know, a miscited code section or a wrong date or something like that. So I don't know. I don't think that's what you're characterizing.
No. I guess this is where I'm.
It's more just a legal conclusion, right?
Legal conclusion number one. But it's even more than that. It's this. When they continually, in their pleadings, in the indictment, in their pleadings, in their extrajudicial comments that they make, they have bombarded the defendants, the electors in this case, with the concept of and the phrase of fake electors. Now that is not. That is a description, a conclusion, and a pejorative description.
Sure. So it's a legal conclusion you very much disagree with. It's the core of your defense.
I think it's not only a legal conclusion, but it's also something that should be stricken because it is just a pejorative statement. I'm not saying, I'm saying, I can call you something really nasty in an indictment, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a legal conclusion about your violation of a particular law. And so that's what we have here. And we have this permeating this case.
Well, I'm just trying to, again, based on what we've seen and is allowable in Georgia, let's just make it simpler. If in a murder indictment someone's alleged to have acted with malice aforethought, that's a legal conclusion.
Well, that's right.
And it's something that the defendant may really have an issue with. But we don't strike it. We just go forward and we go to trial.
Different world, different cases, not the point that I'm trying to make. What I'm trying to make is, and you put in malice aforethought because you put that in there to define the terms.
Sure. What about this one? There's one I remember when we talk about nicknames and aliases. And I remember there's one in Georgia from the 90s. They put in an alias of Stomper. And he had beat the defendant to death.
Well,
and the Supreme Court said, that's okay.
You know why? Because they probably proved that there was an alias of that guy called Stomper. That's different than
at trial. The state's saying we're going to prove that you're unlawful elector.
Well, no. In this indictment, what they have done in the indictment, it's not necessary if they want to. And we think it should be stricken. We think the count should be dismissed. We know that based upon the case law that we've cited. But in closing arguments, Lord forbid we ever get to closing arguments, hope we don't. But if we did, and they stood up and they said, well, we think that they were we think the evidence shows that they were fake electors. That's one thing. That's argument. That's advocacy. There's no place for it in the indictment. And there's no place for it in what they have done, not only in the indictment, but in their pleadings and statements they've made outside to the media. What they have tried to do is they want to have ingrained in the minds of the community and of jurors a concept that if you were not a Democratic elector on December the 14th, casting your vote at the at some other part of the state capitol, then you are a fake elector. And that is a pejorative term, not necessary for the charges, and should be stricken. That's the point that we're trying to make. And as it relates to our other arguments concerning the dismissal of those counts, I don't think I need to go back over most of my argument, or our argument on that really deals with the Electoral Count Act, so I don't think I need to revisit that in case the court
we'll get there
really wants to hear that again. I don't think you do, but absent that, Your Honor, we think, number one, that the count should be dismissed for the reasons articulated earlier and in our pleading, and number two, that even if the counts are dismissed, in addition to that, references throughout the indictment to fake electors should be stricken as well. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Yellen.
Judge, I'll be brief. Nowhere in this indictment is the phrase fake elector. It does not exist. Literally not in the indictment. So I'm not really sure what we're talking about, removing something from the indictment that's not there. As the court pointed out, and I struggle with this motion, and I'm not going to say much because we're primarily relying on our response, but an indictment is itself a legal conclusion. Every allegation in an indictment is a legal conclusion. That's what an allegation is. And so if indictments aren't allowed to have legal conclusions, then I guess we aren't allowed to have indictments anymore. Judge, I think what the defense's strategy is here, and I know it's their strategy because they ask for it in the motion. They say, Judge, you should strike this language from these counts because we don't like it. It's not fair. It's pejorative, whatever reason. And now that you've stricken it, the counts don't charge a crime anymore, so you should dismiss them because they don't charge a crime anymore. That's nonsensical. We cite in our briefs opinions where the court says, the appellate court said, you literally can't do that. If something's essential to the charge, if it's essential to pleading an essential element of the charge, you can't strike it. It's not subject to being stricken. And I just highlight one citation that we reference in our brief, Malloy versus the state, 293 Georgia 350, 2013 Supreme Court case. And that case says that when language in an indictment accurately describes the offenses charged and makes them easier to understand or more easily understood, they're not subject to being stricken because they're not surplusage. And that in making that in analyzing language in an indictment, you know, in this context, Malloy also says that the language is to be interpreted liberally in favor of the state. And so with that, again, we rely on our pleadings. The phrase fake elector does not exist in this indictment. Take any questions that the court may have, but otherwise, nothing further.
Maybe one. You know, I've seen a line of cases talking about whether defects, you know, can be stricken, and a lot of that depended on whether they're material or non-material. Is it safe to say that these phrases, the ones that are highlighted here, lawful elector votes, false electoral college votes, and duly elected and qualified presidential electors, would you say those are material phrases for each of the charges they appear in?
So I think that's a great question, and I think there's kind of a superficial answer and then maybe a more in-depth answer. My superficial answer is yes, they're material in the sense that they make the charges more easily understood. They're accurate to describe the charges. I am familiar with that line of cases, and it's a little bit unclear in the cases whether material means that or whether material means that, you know, if you strike something from the indictment that the count falls apart. Sure. So I'm not clear. What I know is in this context, I don't think it matters because what's being challenged, I think that it's approved of by our appellate decision.
If you've happened to go down that road, though, and we take the position that material means it can still survive general demur. Any thoughts there?
Judge, again, turning back to Malloy, the holding in Malloy is that as long as the language in an indictment, even if it's not essential to an essential element, as long as it's accurate, it describes the offense's charge, and it makes it more easy to understood, it's simply not surplusage. If it's not surplusage, it's not subject to being stricken.
But do we think these phrases are material and meaning they're necessary to survive a general demur? I don't have them in front of me.
I don't either, okay. And so I hesitate to give an answer without the indictment in front of me.
That's fine.
You know, again, as long as the charges track the statute, they survive a general demur. So anything that's not statutory language, I guess, wouldn't fall into that category. But then we get into special demur territory, and that's a whole different situation.
Fair enough.
Thank you, Judge.
Okay. Thank you all. Anything else we should, or matters of housekeeping, anything else we need to take up before we break? Anything from the state?
Nothing from the state, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Young. Anything from either counsel? Okay. Then we'll be adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you,
Judge. Thank you, Judge.
I'll write it down for you. I actually don't have a